From Milieu Media Group, this is Sons and Doubters.
An honest conversation about the times when faith is difficult and doubt is easy.
We're your hosts. I'm Aaron Hale.
And I'm Luke Bronner. This is Season 1, Episode 4, Bazan, with Derek Webb.
Hey everybody, welcome to Sons and Doubters. We actually got to have a conversation with one of our favorite artists and musicians and songwriters and music businessmen and
theological thinkers at least.
Yeah, and Derek Webb. Here you're going to hear a conversation that we had with him. Unfortunately, we got some really crappy audio, and so
I think this is good though. Here's why. I think it's important that people know that, like,
we're only human.
Well, and that we're not professional radio guys. Like, we are not professional podcasters. This is not This American Life. We are two guys who want to have this conversation. We're having it the best way we know how. So,
and I'll tell you so we had the interview, and it is a solid gold interview, if I do say so myself. And I'm not saying that Luke and I are good at interviewing.
It's that we didn't say anything. I think that's what's so good about it.
Yeah, I mean, we're really not good at interviewing, and that's not something that we, like, even would claim. But Derek is just, like, everything he says is, you know, solid gold. And so we were just, like, we kept looking at each other and wanting to high-five across the room. You know, we were like, this dude, oh, gosh, this is exactly, you know,
Let's tell the story of what happened.
Go.
We had those moments of throughout the whole time he's talking, we're kind of silently behind the mic, mouthing to each other, this is perfect. This is what I want this show to be. We finished the interview.
After about 45 minutes to an hour conversation with Derek, we're just like cheering. We're like, oh my gosh, that was incredible.
Up.
You know,
it's perfect.
Hung up.
We look down and realize that the app that we're using, I won't call the app out by name.
I will, and I will.
You don't know it, thankfully.
Cuss at it.
We get to the end of the interview and realize this app failed to record any of the interview that we had just recorded.
But fortunately, we had some technical issues beforehand that we were trying to figure out a way that Derek could hear you and me, Luke and I, like, where he could hear us both talking into our mics.
We're total pros.
And it was just embarrassing. And so we're sitting here trying to figure it out, and Luke is like sweating and I'm like laughing because I don't know what is happening ever. And poor Luke has to put up with me. But we finally figure out a way to do it. And the only way we know how to do it is to not have headphones and just listen through the computer speakers to where we can hear him. And luckily, our microphones picked up the audio from his computer.
I mean, just enough of it for us to send it off to a professional engineer who could mix it in a way that you can hear it today. Now, Derek was very, very gracious and immediately after the conversation told us, like, hey, we can just give it a couple days and we'll just redo the interview. But our concern was that the things he said were so good, we don't want you to miss them. So what you're going to hear is, yes, it is poor audio quality, but the things that Derek has to say are so good. And so we decided it was worth using the poor audio, making it sound as good as we could possibly make it sound. So the audio is poor, but the content of what he had to say was so good, we didn't want to miss out on it or try to recreate it. So we're going to cut now to this interview with Derek Webb, and then we'll spend a few minutes talking afterwards. Here he is. Derek, man, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
I've told you a bit about what we're doing, but just to kind of recap, our goal with this show is to have honest but hopeful conversations about the times when faith is difficult and doubt is easy. We wanted to talk to you specifically because of kind of your role in the church over the course of your career. I feel like you have been consistently sort of on the fringes of mainstream Christian culture and self-described as an agitator. So we kind of wanted to just talk about what that experience has been and I guess how you see your role in the church as an agitator.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to spend some time with you guys. I mean, I think the easiest way for me to try to answer a question like that is to say that I'm just simply wired a particular way, and I just have a particular way that I look at the world and a particular way that I just a certain instinct about how I see things. And some strange reason why some things jump out at me and seem important to me for one reason or the other, and those instincts have not always been in line with the instincts of my evangelical friends, and I've always been this way, long before there was any good use for, any use at all for my particular wiring. Even when I was a kid, I was like this, and I feel like I have kind of an ironic sense of justice, because I think that, you know, when it comes to life and culture, I think that maybe how I can sum it up is that I love rules almost as much as I love breaking them. So it's just been, let's just say, these are not easy instincts to deal with and to live with when I was an adolescent. You know, I had a hard time coming up, and I didn't fit easily into church circles, and I think the church does a lot better with artists and knows how to handle artists and people who maybe have contrary views within their congregations. I think that the church does. I think that conversation feels a lot more open now than it did when I was, I mean, I'm 40-something years old, 41 years old now, so, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, the culture just felt different, and I appreciate that about kind of the contemporary church. It feels like people are a lot more open, yeah. Like it's a much safer place to have more nuanced dialogue, but when I was a kid, it wasn't easy, and so I feel like I came into the church, or into church culture, very much like I came into the kingdom to start with, kicking and screaming. And so I feel like if I have provided any kind of agitation for the church as an institution, it stems out of my primarily agitating myself. You know, I am nothing if not an autobiographer, even if that doesn't seem obvious. There's a reason why I feel like I've chosen particular topics, or certain things have been interesting to me, or certain content kind of followed me around. It's because these are the things that are preoccupying for me personally. These are the things that I deal with or struggle with. There's this great John Lennon quote where he was being asked, when he and Yoko Ono were kind of at the forefront of the anti-war movement, and he was asked, you know, why are you so obsessed with peace? Like, what is it with you and this idea of peace? Why is that so important to you? And his response was, because I know myself to be such a violent man. And I think that is not a bad anecdote for how I got where I am. The things that I have written songs and sang songs about are not things that I feel as though I'm an expert in. They are not things that I feel the best equipped to be the spokesperson for. They are not things that I feel a superiority about, so much as they are things that I have deeply struggled with, which is why I can't manage to stop writing songs about them. And I also kind of liken it. Dave Bazan, who's a great prophetic songwriter and friend of mine, he and I were talking about this, and for those who don't know him, he was formerly in a band called Paper the Lion, and they spent some time in kind of the evangelical space, and people have said about his last few records, although I don't know that I've ever heard him necessarily say that, you know, he, a few records ago, he put out a record called Cursed Branches, which...
Oh, that's one of my favorite records.
Yeah, and it was described by Pitchfork as, you know, Bazan's breakup album of God. You know, he's been very honest and open about his journey, kind of sorting some things out, and he would tell you, though, that even where he is now with spirituality, he still feels as though it's the one thing, I just heard him say this like a week ago, that it's the one thing he still feels as though he is most expert at in his life. Like, there's not anything that he knows more about or is more of an expert in than the spirituality that he now doesn't necessarily profess. And so, but he's made, you know, he's recorded a lot of songs since that album and is continuing to grapple with his spirituality. And the reason is because that's preoccupying for him. And I think that's how I've managed into the content that I have. So I think that's like an important thing. First and foremost, I am a self-agitator. Like, these are the things, the subject matter, the content of my records has always been the things that agitate me. Mm-hmm. And so then I've spent some time thinking about trying to articulate these things, how I feel about them, where I feel like the important points of tension are in them, and then I make records about them. And a few times it's taken me several records to work it out. I mean, the Mockingbird record was very focused on the idea of peace and nonviolence, and I was working through some of that personally, and it took me a whole other record to kind of get it out of my system. And really, ever since that record, there's been some theme of that all throughout, because I do know myself to be somebody who's dealt with rage, and I don't like those parts of myself.
Yeah.
I know what's lingering in the shadows, and part of the how you take the power away from those things is to speak, to say it out loud, to call it by name, to own it, and so, you know, it's taken me a lot of records to do that, and so I think that sometimes I feel like there's the idea that I'm standing over here and looking for things to criticize the church about, and that's kind of been my MO, and it really couldn't be further from the truth. Like, I identify myself as a member of the church, as an institution, and in as far as I'm criticizing and agitating myself, I guess that's true, because if I am part of the church and I'm, you know, punching myself in the stomach, I guess I'm punching the church, but it really has so much more to do with me
than
it has to do with anybody else. And if there's been resonance and anyone has heard this stuff and feels a resonance about it, that unfortunately just means that we probably had a lot in common. It doesn't mean that I've come after anybody. So
yeah, so I have been like a Pedro the Lion, David Bazan fan, super fan, since I was like 14. And I've always put you and David Bazan in the same category of songwriters that I love. So I hope you'll take that as a compliment. But there aren't many songwriters that inspire me and make me excited to get out the liner notes and read each song lyric like you guys do. Because I always know that you'll have something in there that either challenges me or speaks for me in a much more eloquent or beautiful way than I know how to do. But you were talking about how you, these are the things that agitate you. But do you feel like the church or, you know, Christians expect that because you write these songs that you assume that you are an expert in this stuff? I mean, do they assume that, and so they get angry with you and like challenge you on it?
I think that there's been some of that. I think that there has been, I've definitely interacted with some people who come in with that perspective
and yeah.
immediately are bristling because they think that I'm setting myself up as some kind of an authority
right.
On the content that I write about, and it's really, it feels like so much more the opposite. Like, I feel like when I made, and I mean, I can give you examples for every record, but I feel like when I made my first record, when I made She Knows Shall Go Free, I certainly did not feel that I was any kind of expert on the idea of the institutional church. I was learning so much at that moment about the role of the church in culture, my role in the church itself, that I was learning a lot of that for the first time, and it was really revelatory for me, and so I was just writing about it. I was talking a lot about it to my friends, and I was writing about it. And what's interesting about all that is then I feel like the tour that I did for that record, which I actually wound up playing mostly house shows for that first record, which was really a random occurrence because we had a whole tour planned, a full band, normal kind of tour, and which fell apart very much at the last possible moment. And so in order to just get out and do something and not sit at home while the record was coming out, I decided, well, let me throw together some house shows. That would probably be easier than rebooking. And it wound up being one of the most kind of serendipitous moments of my early career. But I learned so much doing it because then I was sitting with people every night, having to work these songs out and sing them. And in that environment, people can ask questions, and it's a very kind of open dialogue.
Yeah.
And I learned so much more the 2 years after I put that record out than I knew going into the making of that record. And so I usually feel like the records that I put out are not my punctuating the end of a season of study or thought on an issue or issues. I feel like it's me lighting the fuse.
Yeah.
A long season of trying to figure some things out. So, yeah, I think that that's kind of the risk you run, though, when you kind of have a didactic voice or when you... Because I also have a forceful personality. I don't mean to do it, but I think I'm just a loudmouth, and the way that I will say things comes off as unintentionally authoritative. I make the mistake often of not being careful to state opinion like fact.
Yeah.
I think that opinion can come out of my mouth sounding like fact because of my personality, which I don't like and try to keep from doing, and I try to use better language to make sure that people understand that I'm not declaring something I believe should or could be true for everyone, but rather my opinion on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most valuable thing in any dialogue you're having with anybody, but especially around religion, is the ability to come into new information, to try to keep yourself in a posture of really listening to the people who you're speaking to, and to the extent that what they might say might take root in your imagination and actually change your views, like make actually change your mind about something you believe. I think it's really important to remain open in that way. And I think Christians of all people should really have no fear about living that way if Christians do believe that they have stumbled into something objectively true about the universe, then they, of all people, should have no fear about really openly engaging
and finding more truth.
Who was it? Was it Lewis who said, or was it Schaefer, I think, maybe, who said, you know, that all truth is God's truth.
Yeah.
It, you know, it originates with God. And so if that's true, I should be able to pick the thread up and identify it almost anywhere.
Yeah, and not be scared of finding something out, you know, or reading the wrong thing.
So engage with that person and maybe camp out and talk about that little bit of truth that maybe we have in common. Maybe, you know, that would be such a better pursuit than focusing on the majority of what we feel like we don't have in common.
Yeah.
You know, and anyway, so.
Well, I was going to say, I remember going to a Bazan show years ago, and I've seen this consistently at his shows, but there was a guy who was like in the crowd, you know, heckling him through the whole show and like challenging his, you know, his lyrics, and he was like singing really loud, like hymns and stuff like that, like just really being obnoxious, and people wanted him to leave. And I remember after the show, I went over to the bar area and David Bazan was just sitting with that guy and they were having like a really deep conversation. And I remember thinking, like, that's amazing that this is the guy that almost ruined his show, and yet he's saying all these things. And so, and David Bazan wanted to sit down and like learn from him, you know?
I'm so not shocked by that. And again, I mean, so now this, yeah, this just became the David Bazan fan club, which is fine. We'll hijack it. And this might kind of go to the question that you asked before. It's like, I think that it's just too tempting. It's too easy to engage only with Dave's lyrics, because he is also a very forceful writer.
Right.
And it's easy to hear what he's writing, especially if it runs contrary to something that you might be believing or dealing with, and to assume about him that he's doing this in a cavalier way.
Right.
Or doing it in a way that is not showing little care for the people who are affected by his disruption. And it just couldn't be further from the truth. I don't think I've ever, maybe ever met someone who is as gentle and thoughtful and generous in terms of relationally generous as Dave is. Like, and maybe he's learned to be that way, but I'll tell you, anyone who kind of goes at him to challenge him in that way, and especially to kind of do it in a public way like that, I think that they're not going to get what they're looking for.
Yeah.
Because what they're looking for is probably some kind of an extreme response. Mm. They want to debate, or they want to. And unfortunately, what they're going to get is him snuggled up to the bar next to them for 2 hours afterwards, you know, listening to them.
Yeah.
And ironically, that's how he got where he is, and that is the path on which he is still. He is still a guy that I find to be completely open.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I wish to be.
Yeah.
But back to your question, I think that when you assume the risk of making statements with art that are like some of these, I think it is really hard to not read a certain amount of narcissism or self-appointed authority or something. It's hard to not read that into it. And I certainly have never intentionally done that. I hate the idea that it must come off that way. And the problem is that I don't really know how it comes off, because I only know it from my perspective. And I have all the additional context in my head of how I got around to the song that I'm singing, the particular lyric that I'm singing. And so it doesn't seem strange to me, but I have all this additional context in my head that keeps me in check in that way. But for people who are just hearing it with fresh ears when it comes out on an album, I can't imagine how that must sound. And they're probably right. So I try to be really patient, and I have probably a lot to learn from a guy like David, because he does it so well. But yeah, I think to answer the question, I think that's just the risk you run.
Yeah.
You know, we talked some on the last couple episodes about how interesting it is that the church is not the place where these things are safe to talk about it. It seems like, ideally, the church would be exactly the place that you would be able to come and wrestle with these ideas. And so the thing that interests me is, in my personal story, when I kind of hit, I don't know, 23, 24, when I started really having some questions specifically about the church. And I was thinking about this earlier. I think that a lot of folks, when we talk about doubt, it doesn't always necessarily come from a true lack of belief so much as a disenchantment with the church. I hear that in so many people's stories, and it's true of mine also. And my response in that time was to leave the church and to say, I can't do this. I love Jesus. I love the church. I love the idea of the church, but I can't be around this iteration of it. It's interesting because your music has played a part in that for me. I feel like you're always about 6 months ahead of me on whatever it is I'm wrestling with. You probably just released an album. It may be your fault that I'm wrestling with it. I don't know. But I'm curious how during this time of my wandering away from the church and looking for a safe place to deal with these things and landing, I think, where you and where Dave, I guess, have landed, and landing in art as a means of processing doubt or processing questions more so. I'm curious how you've done that and stayed faithful to the church through that. You know what I mean?
I do. And I appreciate your question. I appreciate your kind words. I mean, here's the thing, you know, the church, and certainly me in it, especially me, doesn't always, as you said, do a great job with people who are complicated, with people who are in complicated moments, with people who are dealing with complicated things. Ironically, Jesus excelled at that. I've said before that I think that one of the church's greatest misconceptions about itself that really keeps it from being able to do its job to the extent that it really could, and I include myself again in this criticism, is that the church seems to be, the institutional church, the cultural church maybe, seems to be more preoccupied with looking like Jesus than looking like we need Jesus. And I think that the latter would be such a more realistic and more persuasive advertisement for our faith than the former. So I think that I have failed a lot at this, but I think that, and I could tell you theology, I could answer your question with theology about things that I believe or wish to believe, which is maybe the best I do with theology most of the time, which is why I love the liturgy so much. It's a repeated confession of things I wish to believe. But I could answer the question with the things I believe about the church, about the institution of the church, about the future of the church, about Jesus returning for the church and the process the church is in and its indispensable role in the economy of salvation and blah, blah, blah. And honestly, that's not why, though. I think I've probably answered a question like this with those kind of answers a lot. Really, the answer is that I can't escape myself. And so the day that I give up hope, ultimately, in the church, is the day that I give up hope in myself, that I give up any hope. And I've just, tempted as I have been to do so, I've just not managed to do it. And I think that's probably a grace that maybe I don't always acknowledge as such, but the fact that I, complex as my relationship, and more so in more recent years, has been with faith communities, the church as an institute, a visible institution and culture, I can't manage to give up hope ultimately and personally in myself and my own life, and that extends out into the group that I claim to be a part of. So that's maybe why I'm compelled to fight to remain part of the church ultimately. That's not been easy, you know, always.
Yeah.
Honestly, like I'll tell you what my experience just personally has been with some of that is that I feel like that I have been, and on the whole, Christians seem to be, have anxiety around and insecurity about their stated beliefs in, like, direct proportion to, well, no, I should say, they have, and I have had, an arrogance and a rigidity about my spirituality in direct proportion with my internal insecurity about really believing it. And I think that's such a strange irony. I feel like the people who seem to want to fight the most are the ones who are most deeply insecure about the things they're saying. And they're maybe struggling so much with whether or not it's really true that they have to fight that much harder to convince me that it is.
Really, really, you know, cling to it.
Yeah, and ultimately they're just trying to convince themselves. I mean, I think that, you know, especially when, again, I'm going to keep doing it, but when you look at a guy like Dave Bazan, and when you talk to anybody who manages to find some way to be really open and honest about what they actually believe and how it might, and I mean, it's perilous work to be honest about that sort of thing, but it's essential. And I think that what happens with a guy like that, and I feel like I've had a little bit of this in my life recently, where people wind up kind of looking at you and they think they're responding and reacting to you, but you become a Rorschach for those people.
Mm-hmm.
And they look at you. I mean, you look at a guy like Dave, and the liberty with which he's been able to navigate his kind of spiritual journey. And, you know, and here's a guy who's really open and honest about what he's seen and what he believes. And I think most, and he probably sees this and realizes this, which is why he's able to not consider these people his enemies, is that he knows that what ultimately they are mad about and angry about is not him, but it is their own kind of depth of shame or grief, insecurity about the things that he is putting a fine point on.
Right.
And therefore, he and I would wish to have an extra measure of, you know, gentleness and patience and with people who are looking to have those conversations, because you have to move them through that initial stage where they do believe it's a value, which it's not.
Yeah.
I think there are moments when it could be, but on the whole, especially in the very extreme cases, I think you become a mirror for those people, and when they look at you, you're triggering something in them, something very deeply seated that they really need to deal with, and so they're taking the opportunity. You become a cross upon which they wish to hang some of their sin, because they don't realize that that's essentially what they're doing, that you are essentially affording them an allowance from which they can draw to sin against you because they feel sinned against by you. And I definitely, again, think it's not a tremendous advertisement for our Savior, who, again, excelled at loving very complicated people. So, yeah, it's just, it's hard, man. I mean, the stakes are unbelievably high. We're talking about conversations about eternity. What higher stakes anywhere in our culture could we find than these conversations? So I do understand it, you know?
Well, I think I mentioned this on another one of our episodes. I was thinking about you. I used to hear, you know, about some famous actor or celebrity or musician who turns out they're Christian, you know, and you'd be like, oh yeah, Shia LaBeouf is a Christian. Thank God. Like, I can like him, you know, he's on my team. And I've just recently kind of started to break that down and be like, why am I so, the church is really good about hailing celebrities who never claimed to be Christian, who now all of a sudden are. And then the people who were in their camp who do something wrong, they just kick them out immediately. And I'm just curious, like, for you, I envy your bravery, because I'm a singer-songwriter and I've never tried or done anything controversial because I'm just paranoid that I'm going to lose my job at a church, or I really like to be liked. And so I'm curious for you, like, what that's been like with the church. I know we've kind of touched on it a little bit, but is that hard for you?
Well, here's what I'll say. It is, and the answer to your, the specific answer is easy for me, which is that thing that most people have, that part of their personality that people-pleasing, or that at least having some heightened awareness of what people think and caring about that, I have other problems, but I don't have that.
Yeah.
I just don't have it, and I never have. It's part of my peculiar wiring. I've never been all that concerned about what people thought about me, and I've never had a hard time at all, really, with people not liking me. It doesn't really bother me, and if anything, for most of my career, I didn't really feel like I was doing my job unless I was getting that reaction.
Yeah.
I remember the months right before the Mockingbird record came out, right, about 10 years ago, actually, it was definitely kind of trickier waters than I had been in previously, because, you know, 2 years previous, I had put out my first record, and I had made statements in an abstract way about idolatry, and people seemed to be okay with that on the whole. I mean, not everybody. But then when I got specific about idolatry and started to talk about, like, the church's political idolatry, that was too much. So apparently you can call somebody a whore, but you can't call them a Republican.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that song, or that record, really, was like a point for me where, like, I feel like I was at the point where I thought, I can't handle the church anymore. And you kind of, your voice kind of came in and made it to where it was like, hey, you're supposed to, you know, you're supposed to love the church. And it really helped me to be like, okay, I love the idea of the church. Now, can we just get there, you know, rather than just leaving it all together?
No, I appreciate that. And so, you know, so for me, it's like, I remember it, touring, and I was in, to be fair, I was in the South. I think it was probably down in Texas somewhere. And I was touring. I was playing the Mockingbird songs, but no one had heard the record yet. So the people who were coming into the shows, I don't think totally knew what they were in for. And I remember several nights in a handful of towns where midway through different songs off that would go on to be on that record that later that year when it came out, like a third of the audience would get up in big groups and leave. And I remember like a lot of nights promoters coming up to me after and being, Joe, just like kind of falling all over themselves and being just so apologetic. I'm so sorry. I can't believe, you know, they were just so disrespectful and I'm sorry. And I was like, I told them, like, man, this is like the best night I've ever had. This is exactly, like, I'm more, it bothers me more when people have no reaction. I don't mind people having a positive reaction. I hope that doesn't get, I mean, I don't think the world would be a better place if everybody thought like me. So I'm not trying to make converts to my worldview specifically. But at the same time, I wouldn't have my opinions if I didn't think they were right. Everybody thinks their opinions are right. There's nothing wrong with that, as long as they understand that they're opinions.
Yeah.
If I thought somebody else's opinion was better, I would have those opinions. And so the point is, I'm not trying to convert anybody. I don't mind if people like what I'm saying, and I don't mind if people don't like what I'm saying. What bothers me is when people aren't paying attention and when people are disengaged and kind of asleep.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I just love a reaction.
Yeah.
I don't do it for the reaction, but that's definitely something I look for as an indicator that I'm doing my job.
Right, right.
Either people rally around or flee from whatever I'm saying, and I'm okay with either response equally, honestly.
Yeah.
So that's made it really easy for me. That's made it easy to be in my particular job and play my particular role in whatever season and be okay, because if anything, I enjoy it, and I try not to. There have definitely been times where I feel like I shouldn't be enjoying it so much. I don't want to wind up doing it for that reason, and I've probably erred on both sides of that line. But just really briefly to go back to what you're saying before, I think one thing that a lot of, especially my Christian friends, don't seem to be willing to do, and that I have found really liberating personally, is to own the idea that your practical beliefs, the beliefs that you are, when you look at your life and look at your actual behavior, and what are the things that you are believing when you just look at the way you're living, and the role that some of these, the importance some of these things play in your life. Your practical beliefs are your actual beliefs.
Yeah.
And the sooner that you can realize and own that and kind of start your spiritual journey over from there each day, I think that it takes so much of the pressure off, as opposed to saying, well, practically, very clearly, I'm believing these few things, but I know that's not right, and I know that's not what I should be believing, so I'm actually not going to say that's what I believe. I'm going to say I believe these things. And I'm not saying that it's not good to, as I said before, take something like the liturgy and say, these are things I wish to believe, and so I'm going to continue to recite this creed every single week in hopes of believing it. I'm going to continue to sing these hymns every week in hopes of believing them.
Yeah.
I'm going to continue to read this text every week, every day, in hopes of believing it. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
While you're in that journey, in those moments, it's also a really good and healthy thing to say, however, practically,
yeah,
the things I'm actually believing, they're actually getting me through my life right now. And if I am honest, there are a lot of moments and a lot of days and extended days where, if I'm honest with you about my practical belief being my actual belief, I am probably, I would say that I'm, most days I am a theist.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there is some rhyme or reason, some design behind the way that all things work and the way that all things have been set up and operate and the way the universe is. But if I'm honest, a lot of days, if I do believe that there is a deity in the universe, I don't believe I can trust that person.
Yeah.
And to really believe that force is trustworthy. Now, that's some of the time for me, and I need to be honest about that and not say that that's not true in order to not progress from that moment. Because I think that's the other problem that people have, is when they have hard moments, complicated moments in their spirituality. I think that people are so anxious in our world of distilled information and distilled truth and distilled headlines, but with no nuance. I think it's tempting to want to put a flag down. And I think I've got a lot, yeah, of friends who've gone through hard seasons and have been a little too anxious to put a flag down, and it stunts your growth. And I don't think that's healthy. I don't think that's being truly open.
Right.
I don't think there's anything that helps a journey to say, right this moment, I'm having a hard time believing that there's any benevolent force out there, so now I'm going to put a flag down and call myself an agnostic.
Right.
I would rather say, here's how I'm feeling right this minute. Here's the data upon which I'm basing that feeling. Here are the things that I wish to believe to be true that I'm going to put along with all that data, and I'm going to sit in that, I'm going to feel that, and I'm going to process it and continue walking through it. But I've never seen anybody who's benefited from putting a flag down too early, because then you identify yourself a certain way, and even the internal conversation is over.
Yeah.
And I don't think that doesn't feel healthy to me. I want to keep moving all the time. And the last thing I'll say is that for anyone who is doubting to this extent and who really is tearing down their system of belief spiritually down to the studs and rebuilding it, maybe are in a season like that and maybe feeling like it's perilous for them to be doing that, but maybe not having the other choice. Here's what I would say, at least for me personally, if the things that I have for the majority of my life believed to be true about my spirituality and about the fact that no sin that I could commit, and not even myself, not even I can pluck myself out of Jesus' hand, if that is where I am, and if he has pursued and captured me, if that's really true, you know, if the language about the book of life and the names written therein, if those things are true and determinations made before the foundation of the world, the way by which God governs whatsoever comes to pass, if these things are all true, then I should, and neither should anyone else, have any fear of sitting in those long moments and seasons of doubt. Because all of that happens in the context of the truth of all those things that you maybe are not even currently believing. If those things are true, then I have every liberty and I'm in no peril to really take a hard look at these things if ever I feel as though I must. And I think it's important to remember, like, and maybe this is just me, maybe I'm just old school, but I can't shake the idea that there are things that are objectively true that have nothing to do with my belief in them, and my belief in them in no way confirms or verifies their veracity or their truthfulness, that I have kind of nothing to do with what's really true. I can look for it, hope to find it, hope to grasp it, hope it grasps me, but at the end of the day, it's got really nothing to do with me. And if that's true, then I should feel safe and even a responsibility to really, truly, and deeply doubt. I think it's important that I do that, and I do it in view of, with line of sight to, maybe that objective reality that says, you know, you can do all of that, but you can't struggle your way and doubt your way and pluck yourself out of God's hand. You know, so I think that's an important thing for people to feel safe to do that.
Yeah, we've talked about that some, just the idea of trusting the truth to be true and lean into that kind of freedom.
Yeah, and as you seek truth, that truth will be found, right?
Yeah. Man, well, we don't want to take up your whole day, but we would love to definitely have you back on. This is so good. Did you have anything else that you wanted to say about David Bazan before we wrap up?
Yes, actually, and this will be the last of it. But I would say that for anybody who's not a fan of David Bazan's, I mean, especially if you found your way to this particular podcast, you really should hear the album Cursed Branches. I've never heard a braver and more faithful examination of personal spiritual belief than the lines on that album, and he's continued to do so, and there's context before that album that leads to it, and you should see all that stuff, but it's so good. And not only that, but he continues to do so, and he's putting out these records right now called Bazan Monthly, and I think he's in his second year of Bazan Monthly, and I talked about this with him recently, and that he is like secretly making the best albums of his life right now, but he's releasing them in this really innovative way. So I think people are missing.
Yeah.
These aren't just these random patchworked songs. Like, he's still constructing big, broad statements across 10 to 12 songs. That's still what he's doing. He's kind of sneaking out the best records of his career right now. And so if you're a Bazan fan or have been, and you are missing the Bazan Monthly stuff that's been coming out recently, you need to go get caught up.
Yeah.
This is a man who thinks more thoughtfully and is arguably, and I think he would even own this, more in the biblical tradition of doubt. He's a psalmist. I mean, he's prophetic, and he's very, even now, more so than ever, maybe, he's very squarely in that tradition. I think he would even acknowledge that. And you really don't want to miss what he's writing, especially if you found your way to this podcast. I think that you would find a lot of resonance. Anyway.
You guys have made me kind of want to go to a show and be confrontational just so I can sit and have a beer with him and talk for a while.
Yeah. Well, Curse Your Branches is like this record that I, like, depending on the song, I either have my hand over my mouth like, oh my gosh, I can't believe he's saying this, or I'm like weeping, you know? It's like such a powerful record.
Yeah, yeah.
Derek, thanks so much for your time, man, and for being on with us. We would love to bring you back on maybe with Dave one of these days.
Yeah.
And,
man, it's a pleasure to talk to you guys. Thank you so much.
We'll talk to you again soon.
This episode of Sons and Doubters is sponsored in part by Nice Custom Goods. Nice Custom Goods are made by hand by one man in one workshop in South Houston, Texas. The things we do should last, and that includes the things we buy. So buy something you can pass down. Check out www.nicecustomgoods.com and follow them on Instagram at Nice Custom Goods. Now, back to our show.
So thankful to have had the time to talk with Derek, and I'm confident we will bring him back on, hopefully with Dave Bazan.
Yeah, with David Bazan. That'd be amazing. But I mean,
another episode where we can just sit and listen, which is great.
Yeah. And next time we will make sure everything is working properly.
Yeah. You know, there was a thing that he said that stuck with me when he talked about how much he loves the liturgy because it forces him to affirm this belief in things that he longs to believe but doesn't always believe well. And man, that's just such an honest statement that is so hard for me. And I remember the first time I ever heard him say that, it was on the House Show, an album he did several years ago. He talked about, you know, not believing the gospel as every day, so that he needs to hear it and needs to say it to kind of constantly believe it.
Which, when he was talking about the liturgies, practicing of liturgies, it reminds me of a book, Imagining the Kingdom by James K.A. Smith, which is all about the liturgies and practices of our lives, the rituals that we go through every day, not just in church, but in our own lives, are pointing our hearts in the direction of what we consider to be, quote, the good life. And so we need these practices. If we believe that the good life, we believe that in the gospel, and we believe that Jesus is the good life, the kingdom of God is the good life, then we should be doing these rituals and these practices, liturgies that are pointing us in the direction of him. Hmm. And I think that's kind of what he was talking about a little bit. I almost said that in the interview.
Yeah.
That's what he says.
That's what he's saying. And that, and the thing that challenges me is just the honesty with which he says it. The honesty to be able to say, there are days that I don't believe.
The vulnerability, yeah.
And I wonder if that's the reason why his role has been as an agitator for so long, why he rubs people the wrong way. Because he is pushing the church to be that safe place for this conversation, for these kind of conversations.
Yeah, I actually heard him say, and I don't think he didn't say in the interview, but I heard him say one time that if your church gathering looks more like an Amway meeting than it does AA, then you're doing it wrong. And I think that's totally how we should be.
Yeah.
And he did say in the interview that we should try less to look like Jesus and more to look like
people who need Jesus. Yeah. Man, that was so good.
Yeah.
Well, we want to thank you guys for listening to episode number 4. We'd invite you to like us on Facebook, facebook.com/sonsanddoubters. Follow us on Twitter, on Instagram, @sonsanddoubters. We thank you guys for listening. We'll see you next week. Sons and Doubters is brought to you by Milieu Media Group.
This episode was produced by Luke Bronner and Aaron Hale, with production assistance from Wes Martin.
Theme music was composed and produced by Derek Webb.
Artwork was designed by the badass Heather Hale.
Special thanks to Aaron Ivey and Kyle Lent at the Audio Village in Austin, Texas, for giving us a few hours in their studio.
Now here are a few scenes from episode 5 featuring Barnabas Piper.
There's just sort of this pattern of dishonesty where I had kept certain sins to myself, and they had, as sins do, when you don't deal with them, they get stronger than you are. And it ended up getting me fired from a job. And so then everything kind of became public. And so all of a sudden, they're looking at me, and then they know my questions. That was when the questions turned from sort of this tacit obedience and unbelief kind of thing to a much more conscious, why do I believe what I believe? Do I really believe them? What is true? And kind of sorting through what was genuine and what wasn't, I think God used that really significantly to keep me pointed in the right direction.